Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, March 1st, 2013. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by my co-host, Jackie McIntosh.
Hello.
Hi, Jackie. I'm so glad you're here. Jenny Remphel is another co-host of ours. She's on her way, and she'll be joining us shortly. Alyssa is away today, so welcome, Jackie. Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage the movement toward a world in which animals are treated with compassion and mercy and are afforded respect. This program can be heard every Friday from noon till 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at coopradio.org and available as podcasts on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. Animal Voices is the media sponsor of an upcoming grand event in Vancouver next weekend, and that is the Vegan Prom. For our first interview today, we'll have Vegan Prom organizer and my friend Melissa Balfour on the show to tell us all about this event. Where is it happening? Why is it happening? And what should I wear? Most important question.
Yeah.
Stay tuned to hear all about this exciting event and stay especially tuned in to the end of the show where we will be debuting a live performance of the official Vegan Prom theme song composed and performed none other by our own Jenny Remphel herself. Ooh. I'm very much looking forward to that. And for our feature interview today, we'll have author and lawyer Dr. Stephen Wise on the show. Stephen is the president and founder of an organization called the Non-Human Rights Project. It is based in the United States, and it is the only organization of its kind, as its goal is to win the legal status of personhood for animals. That is to say that the Non-Human Rights Project, if it achieves its goals, non-human animals will be regarded as persons and not as property under the eyes of the law. This would be a major breakthrough for animals in our society, and I'm really looking forward to finding out more about this organization and this campaign. This interview is coming up in about 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned.
Yes, and last week, as I'm sure many of our listeners know, was Vancouver Animal Advocacy Camp. It was a wonderful venue for all animal advocacy and animal rights advocates to get together and learn new effective ways to outreach. There were some amazing speakers, including Liz Marshall, who Liz actually interviewed on the show last week, to speak about her upcoming film, The Ghosts in Our Machine, which I'm very excited about. Twyla Francois of Mercy for Animals Canada was there to speak about the amazing courage of their undercover investigators and to share some videos and stories. Also, Olivier Baravel shared some amazing technological alternatives to harming animals in education, particularly for those in the medical field. I found this part very interesting in particular. Mm-hmm. It was inspiring to see all these advances in technology and really proved how realistic these alternatives are. I even remember people like covering their eyes because some of the videos.
Yeah, maybe you could actually talk about what are you talking about? Because I didn't even know that any of these educational, as he called them, alternatives existed. In my mind, these shouldn't even be alternatives. Why are we doing tests and research on animals in universities and high schools and like doing dissections of animals when it's humans that the students need are that's their intention to study? So why are we using animals? It shouldn't even be an alternative. But what can you maybe tell us about?
I mean, some of them are for veterinary medicine as well, but I think I think the main thing is it's just the same as everything. It's how it's always been. People are I guess afraid and apprehensive to anything, any kind of change. But some of the alternatives that he showcased were using cadavers and connecting them to I don't know exactly how it worked, but a blood system, so it
those
made the blood flow.
Cadavers? I wasn't sure because
they were cadavers.
I know he used he was showing models as well, and I didn't realize that they were real.
there were some that were models, and there were some that were as he said, ethically sourced cadavers. So cadavers that had volunteered for when they, or
that
people that had volunteered.
That spurted out blood when you cut into
them. Exactly. Yeah, it was amazingly realistic. And there was also some computer virtual reality systems, which were really interesting. So yeah, I find it really interesting, like you said, that we are still using animals when these methods are clearly more accurate.
I think they're superior.
They are superior, and that's what
he
said.
They're more accurate than using than using animals, because this is like for med students who are practicing. Sure, I'm not talking about the vet students, because that's more, even so for the vet students, they had like these models of cows where you would learn how to dig your hand through them to pull out a calf that was, what's it called?
Breached
pregnancy. Yeah, and that was so cool how they showed that.
Well, and the thing too, and it was also for military military environments where obviously a pig or a goat, like that's not really representative of what a human goes through. It was really interesting. And also, I think it helps people, you know, maintain their compassion, which, of course, if you're going into the medical field, you need to have a sense of compassion. And so many people become desensitized.
He mentioned
through this
that
process.
As one of the disadvantages of using animals is that people, they sort of like they try to put down their emotions by making jokes and making light out of it, which is disrespectful to the animals, of course, that they're using. But also it's psychologically draining and detrimental to themselves because they're trying to push that out of
their mind.
That's
the only way they can do it. And then,
trying to cope. He said he's seen that personally, right? So it's, that's how human emotion works.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking to see that for sure. And the breakout sessions at the Animal Advocacy Camp were also really great. It was wonderful to speak in an open format with fellow animal advocates about the issues that matter to us most. Some of the breakout sessions that I went to included intersections of oppression, creative advocacy, effective vegan arguments, and creative DIY animal rights arts and crafts. What are some of the workshops you went to, Allison?
So I went to the effective arguments part two one, the one that you went to on Sunday. That one was so popular that they had to do two of them. And it was run by a man, I believe his name was Martin, or is Martin. He said he's an instructor at Capilano College.
Yeah, philosophy.
He must be a philosophy instructor, because he had really good ways of how to refute animals. Arguments when people make dumb arguments against vegetarianism or animal rights, for example.
Yeah.
And I really liked the way that I actually was the note taker for that session. So I'm going to go back and look at my notes. I actually would love to have him on the show to maybe
talk to us about some of these tactics and techniques.
There were a lot of people, or quite a few people, that facilitated workshops. So how, for people who don't know how this conference worked, was that it's called an unconference. You go there, and then the people who are attending set their own agenda at the beginning of the day on each day. So if you think of something on the second day that you want to do a workshop on, you can bring that up on the second day. And then some people actually did come prepared, which was kind of cool, but you didn't have to. All you really had to do was come prepared with a topic, but then you were in charge of facilitating your group. So there was this person, Martin from Cap College, as I'll call him, who knew he wanted to talk about arguments and then did it twice because it was so popular.
Absolutely.
Melissa Balfour, who we're going to have on the show very shortly, she presented a workshop on how to talk to media.
Yeah, I missed that one.
Yeah, that one sounded really interesting. And then Carissa Thorpe, who used to be on our show, she's a journalism student now, and she also presented a similar type of workshop on media strategies and tactics. There was the there were very practical workshops like that you and I attended some of them. And then you and I also attended one that was not. It was a fun workshop on
crafting.
That was
really fun. It was a good way to end the day, I think, because we were all kind of like, oh, this all sounds awful, and then all of a sudden, at the end of the day, we're doing arts and crafts and.
Talking about it.
Yeah.
So arts and crafts for animal rights. That just sounded sort of like a fun session to attend. And I know Alyssa presented a workshop on self-care for animal rights.
Yeah, she said that went really
advocates.
Well.
Yeah. So, and that's something that if our listeners are regular listeners, you'll know that Jackie, Alyssa, and I are currently engaged in a series of workshops on self-care, and which is specifically applicable to people who are working in the animal rights movement, because that's something that you always need to keep in check. And I'm glad that was really well attended for her.
Yes.
I Fell in Love with a Meat Eater was also a really interesting workshop. What a great idea. A lot of people attended that one, actually.
That's a huge moral dilemma, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, so I actually really enjoyed attending that one. And but I think maybe you want to talk a little bit just about the networking.
I thought the networking was great because a lot, like there was quite a few people that I think both both you and I had said we hadn't seen previously in, you know, in animal rights events and things.
Right.
So it's amazing.
You think you know everyone when you're living in Vancouver. Like, I know who all the vegans are. I know who all the animal advocates are and the AR people. But such is not the case.
No. And it's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing.
There, just to let people know, there are about 90 people who showed up each day, and not the same people every day either.
Yeah. And it was amazing just because when you see people that you don't usually see at these events, it's good to know that there's more out there and there's more that are wanting to get involved in this kind of work. And I think this can be an inspiring event to those people because they realize, you know, oh, I'm not alone, because they can be maybe like in the more of the suburbs where they don't feel that involved. And I think also the important thing of this event is it kind of gets everyone together, and I think this needs to continue more than just once a year. Mm-hmm. I think we need to be...
That's why I started the Facebook group, so that we could at least be connected online, because there were so many great ideas. People had great ideas. Like, someone wants to do animal rights themed film screenings. And
yeah, and the arts and crafts one.
Or the let's
That's
get to,
amazing.
Yeah,
we need to do that.
We need to make
buttons. I'm excited about that.
We talked about borrowing Jonathan's button maker and having a button making
such
session.
A powerful outlet for people, I think.
But not even that, but just really serious issues as well, and just sort of getting all together and combining our forces and our knowledge and our efforts and expertise and interests together in the community in Vancouver to work together for the animals. And I want to say that this can apply to any community, not just Vancouver. So, that was Animal Advocacy Camp.
Yes.
And if people are kind of curious as to what it was about, the website's still up, animaladvocacycamp.ca. You can check that out.
Yes, and I suggest you do.
Did you know that Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, has over 90 different shows produced by over 350 community members? This wide range of programming produced by our diverse group of programmers ensures that we have a show you'll love. We have shows on feminism, spirituality, disability rights, politics, unions, and parenting. We play jazz, indie rock, reggae, blues, and folk. We broadcast in a dozen different languages and have more First Nations programs than any other radio station in Vancouver. Find your show on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. All different, all the time.
Hello. And so today we're going to start out with some events now. First off, at the Vancouver Vegan Prom will take place on March 9th at Wise Hall at 1882 Adenac Street in Vancouver. It will take place from 8 p.m. to midnight. Also, this is a 19-plus event, so please leave your children at home. This is a great event for anyone wanting to get to know more people in the vegan community or just have a great date night out. If you're inspired by all the vegan heroes, the prom this year is superhero themed, so it leaves a lot to your imagination. You can create your own superhero or dress up as someone who already exists. You could dress up as Kale or just come as your super self. Tickets are on sale now at a variety of retailers, and you can get more information on where to get tickets at veganprom.ca.
Or
and you can search
on our interview.
Veganprom YVR on Facebook to get more information on their Facebook page. We're actually going to be interviewing Melissa Balfour about the event today, so that should be great. Are you guys planning on attending the event?
Of course.
Absolutely.
It was so fun last time, and you seem like you're out of breath. So take a pause here, Jenny, thank you for coming in.
You're running in here.
And I want to remind
you. Like a superhero. Yeah.
Anyways, the last vegan prom was a lot of fun. I guess we'll have time to talk about that during the interview, but it was a lot of fun, and I hope you're all going. You'll be there for sure, Jenny. And
you
took our picture last time, I remember. Mm-hmm. So
I just bought tickets, so.
Yay!
Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm super excited. I'm also really excited because on March 13th at 6:30 p.m., Liberation BC is presenting a free screening of the award-winning film, The Peaceable Kingdom. And Animal Voices actually just hosted a screening of this recently. So
if you missed it...
Yes, you should go, definitely.
Or if you loved it so much when you went to our screening, definitely.
Bring your family and friends.
Yeah, bring people to this one, for sure.
They're encouraging a lot of different people to attend, so especially if you know people who eat meat and you want to bring them out to the screening, that's really what they're targeting for
the
event.
At the Animal Advocacy Camp, Mary Chris was saying they specifically want meat eaters to attend the event, which is a great form of advocacy and outreach, really. It's bring your loved ones to a film, and it's a wonderful, beautiful film, too.
It is.
It's not like you're tricking them into turning them into a vegan or anything.
No.
Like, it's a beautiful film about how humans and animals relate to each other.
And how people get that awakening. Yeah, and I think they said they can seat up to 400 people.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
So try to get as many people to come.
Rio Theater, right?
Yes.
Yes, and it's a free screening, so there shouldn't be any cost barriers there. A little bit about the film. It's a riveting story of transformation and healing, and it explores the awakening consciousness of several people who grew up in traditional farming culture, who've now come to question the basic assumptions of their previous way of life. And it's presented through a woven tapestry of memories, music, and breathtaking accounts of life-altering moments. So it kind of provides some insight into the farmer's perspective with the animals under their care, and the complex web of social, psychological, and economic forces that have led them to the present dilemma that we're in. And I think this affects all of us, so it should be a really interesting event.
Absolutely.
The last couple events I've got here, one of them is the Vancouver Institute for Social Research. They're an independent, para-academic, theory-based free school, and they're starting very soon in 2013. So their intent is to move beyond the borders of a traditional university education and open up more of an accessible platform in the city for engaged discussion and critical theory. So I know a lot of animal rights advocates out there are critical thinkers, so this might be a cool opportunity for you. They've got a variety of topics and courses that they're going to be offering, and they're launching a 9-week pilot project in right at the end of February now, and it ends on April 1st. So it'll be once a week on Monday evenings from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Orr Gallery on 555 Hamilton Street, and there's going to be 9 different professors on a variety of topics, so it might be a good way to engage yourself in the community. You can find more information at their website, visfreeschool.wordpress.com. That's visfreeschool.wordpress.com.
Wonderful.
And our last event that we've got today is the Strong Women, Strong Music event. This is supporting the female human animals out there. So you can join Atera Women's Resource Society for some amazing jazz superstars. It's a big fundraiser for them, and it's their 6th annual Strong Women, Strong Music concert event. So the lineup includes a bunch of female performers, and tickets are $30 in advance, or $35 at the door, and $20 for students or seniors with valid ID card. The doors open at 6:30 p.m. and the performance starts at 7:15, and that's coming up really soon. So please contact Kate at event@atera.bc.ca for more information on that.
So thank you for the events. I just wanted to remind everyone you're listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And now it's time for our first interview. Go ahead, Jenny.
Awesome. So today we're going to be welcoming to the show Melissa Balfour, who's one of the organizers of the Vancouver Vegan Prom. So we're really excited to have her. Melissa was part of the prom committee for the last prom that happened at the end of 2011. So we're excited to have the event back. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you, ladies, for having me on the show.
Anytime. Always a pleasure to talk to you. So maybe you could just introduce the event to us a little bit. Why Vegan Prom, and what is Vegan Prom?
Well, I believe that people that are animal advocates and people who choose to lead a vegan lifestyle, they spend a lot of time outside of their work hours just advocating on behalf of the animals and doing a lot of work. And it seems natural that we should be able to celebrate this and have an event that's fun and light and really kind of celebrates the vegan lifestyle and what it's all about.
That's just a wonderful way to put it all. I hadn't thought of that before. I just want to dance.
Yeah, me too.
There's a couple songs about that. Maybe we'll hear them at the prom. Actually, that's a great question. Are you taking song requests, Melissa?
Yes, absolutely. If people log on to our website at veganprom.ca, they can go to our music page, and there's a form they can fill in, and our DJ takes song requests all week leading up to prom.
That's amazing. Maybe you can tell us, how did the idea come about for the prom?
Sure. There are a few other community proms that have popped up around the city, and there are vegan proms that are happening in New York City and Portland, and actually as well as Denver, too. And our vegan prom started when Nicole Reed, who is a longtime Vancouver vegan and a wonderful animal advocate, decided that we should have a vegan prom. And so she kind of gathered up a committee and led us to the first prom in 2011.
Wow, that's amazing.
It was a lot of fun, as I was saying before. So thank you for organizing that last time, Melissa, and everyone else who did. It was just a great time to be had. And mm-hmm. I really hope that even more people will attend this time. Because you know when there's an event that's happening for the first time, you kind of don't really know, right? Because it's never been done before. And I bet you didn't know either. You didn't know if people would come. So.
No, I know. And then before, we were all cringing because we were like, what if no one comes? And then we ended up with, I think, 130 people.
People came.
It was pretty full, I remember. Can I ask a quick question? What are you planning to change, if anything, from the previous vegan prom? Or is there anything different this year?
Kind of. That's a really good question. It's at the same location. And we'll have a snack table. But this time, the food buffet is going to have more of a kind of a 50s retro feel to it. So our amazing food chair person, Krista Truman, has come up with this incredible menu.
And past Animal Voices host, I should mention.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yes.
So she's come up with this incredible menu. Mm-hmm. And honestly, if I don't eat all the food before you get there, then it's going to be surprising.
I was volunteering at the food table last time. Wow. Was the food ever great? So kudos to Krista. She's amazing with food.
We have a few things that are a little bit different this year. This year we have sponsors, which we're really excited about. Daya has come on as our lead sponsor, and we've also got Field Roast, New World Natural Foods, and Famous Foods, and so they're really helping us be able to provide a lot more services, be able to actually pay for services too, which is great for our photo booth and our DJ, which we feel that artists really need to be recognized, mm-hmm. and we really want to be able to provide them with a small remuneration. And also, we've got tickets are different this year because we're selling them at the door. Yay!
Oh, good, good.
Yeah, so we had to turn back a few people last time. So.
Oh. that's awesome. And so can you tell us just some logistical information? When and where is the event? How can people get tickets?
Sure. The event is March 9th, and it's actually from 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. Last time it was until midnight, and so this time we've had it extended an hour, which is super exciting. And it's at the Wise Hall, which is in Vancouver at the corner of Adnac and Victoria. And people can get their tickets through 5 different stores if they want to purchase them in person and support a local vegan shop. So we've got Carnivore Vegan Shop, Nice Shoes, Fairy Cakes, Eternal Abundance, and Edible Flowers is all selling our tickets. And, of course, they can go online at veganprom.ca and purchase tickets there. And tickets are $18 before the event, but there is an online fee if they purchase them online, or they're $20 at the door.
Oh, awesome. And are there any opportunities to volunteer or get free or discounted tickets for the event?
Absolutely. We have put out a call for volunteers, again, through our website. If people want to go on there and fill in the form, there is an orientation that they need to attend, which is on Sunday. Although I do believe there's a little bit of flexibility with our project manager, Lisa. If you can meet her another time during the week, if Sunday doesn't work for you, then you can do that as well. And so if they fill in the form, we get their contact info, then they can do a 1 to 2 hour shift on the night of the event, which would help us a lot. And they get a free ticket.
Oh, yay. And so food is included with the tickets. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Food, photo booths, music, of course, Stairway to Heaven, hug at the end of the evening could also be included.
Are you doing the photos again, Jenny?
I am, yes. Awesome. I'm very excited. Actually, I hear Melissa has made a wonderful backdrop for the photo booth.
Actually, we do that as a committee.
Oh,
we work together.
Team
and we crowd, you know, there's actually a lot of interesting work that goes on behind the scenes. We like to make everything ourselves, and we meet once a month for every month leading up to it, and we sit and make like all the decorations by hand.
Yeah, I just want to mention that last time the decorations were really well done. I think I don't know, I might be wrong, but it seems like you spearheaded that, Melissa, because that's sort of your thing. You're crafty too.
yeah, I'm crafty too. It's definitely a group effort. We all kind of come together. We've all got different kinds of skills. Like Lisa and Sarah do a lot of sewing, so they're making the tablecloths. And Sabrina Wood is also incredibly crafty, so she's spearheaded a lot of different ideas. And then there's our creative director, Michelle Lee, who is just so genius. She's done all of our posters, and oh, it's just incredible, the stuff that she does. And of course, Krista has her magic hands in the food, and Sarah, yeah, they're all just incredible.
So seeing as you're sewing tablecloths for this event, would that would I be wrong to guess that perhaps you're planning future vegan proms, that the tablecloths won't dissolve, just be used for this one event, but there's some investment there, it seems like, in your efforts.
There is, and there's also the issue of sustainability. Like, we just,
of course,
we don't want to go out and purchase just a bunch of plastic things that can be used once and then thrown away. That's the environment is kind of at the heart of everything that we do and what we believe in. And so I there's been some discussion of perhaps having a rental catalog after each of these events that other community groups can rent from, and then the money from that can go on to more events that we'd like to produce in the future.
That's an awesome idea.
But we're just thinking, so I don't know. Maybe it will happen, maybe it won't. So I don't want to commit to anything right now.
Speaking of all of these fun things that you guys are creating for the event, I've noticed there's a lot of fun promotional elements present, such as the Vancouver Vegan Superhero Name Generator and the Top 10 Myths About Vegan Prom post on your website. Could you speak a little bit about the promotional strategy for the prom and what our listeners might expect to see coming up in the future?
Ooh. I don't know if there was exactly a promotional strategy per se, as much as there are a lot of things that we talk about in meetings that we get really excited about, and if there's one person who wants to kind of take on something for a blog post, then we're very supportive and we encourage them to do so. And I mean, we have, Michelle does beautiful designs, and, you know, a lot of others have great way with words, so I think it's a way to kind of showcase the talent that we have within our committee collective, and just kind of making people shine in whatever way they choose to do so.
That's amazing. How do I join this collective, this creative team?
You're part of it already, really.
If our listeners wanted to get involved, though, do you guys do like a call out every year to recruit people, or is it more word of mouth? How did the team come together?
I think it originally came together because it was from Nicole, and she recruited people that are close to her and friends. And it seems that in like an odd twist of fate, we each have abilities that we bring to the table that kind of covers a general scope. So maybe next year we'd recruit more. I'm not sure. I think that would have to be something that the committee would have to decide on a whole. But if we do so, I'm sure we'll post information about it.
So tell us more about the superhero-themed aspect of the prom. And, Melissa, what do I wear?
You can wear whatever you like, except for maybe fur.
So I can wear, like, a Wonder Woman costume? Like a...
I could totally see you as Wonder Woman. That would be amazing.
Super vegan.
People are encouraged to make up their costumes. I think I heard about one costume that the folks at Carmivore are planning, but I'm not going to tell because it's going to be super cute. And I don't know, just be creative and have fun with it. There is no competition or contest. You know, we just want to do it for fun. And you can either come as an established superhero or one that you make up yourself. Or you don't have to dress up at all and just, you know, come to enjoy the festivities. It's all fine.
So can you just clarify, though, quickly? So, like, should I dress like I'm going to a prom or dress like a superhero
question.
A hybrid? Or
last time, people, there was just really a mix. People wore what they wanted. They went all out. It was the theme was thrift store or something, and some people really embraced that. Others didn't, you know.
You know, it's about embracing it at the comfort level that you are comfortable with. So if you want to go all out and rent a superhero costume and come as someone that you really love and you want to represent, that's awesome. If you want to wear a t-shirt with a superhero logo on it, that's also awesome. Or if you, you know, just want to go in your prom clothes because you want to dress up and go on a date or you know, have a great night with your girlfriends or guy friends, that's amazing too. There's kind of no limit at this point.
It's a really free event, too, as in, like, speaking of dates, you don't have to have a date. Like, just go there and you'll find one.
You'll find people to dance with. That's what happened last year. We'll all dance together, really.
Actually, I got some great photos of that, yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Melissa. Thanks, Melissa. Really appreciate you coming on the show to tell us more about the prom.
No worries.
And once again, the website is veganprom.ca, so
that's
go
right.
and check that out if you want more information about the event. Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Have a good
thank
day.
You. Okay.
You are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Cooperative Radio in Vancouver, BC, Canada. And I have some news events to tell you guys about. I'm not sure if you've heard about this at all, Jenny, but a man was accused of shooting Forrest the dog in Cleveland. You haven't heard about that?
Oh, actually, someone sent me a cause event on mm-hmm. Facebook about it, but I was curious to have more information. Do you know more
yeah.
about what happened?
Well, originally, they dismissed the cruelty charges, but now they've realized that Clements, 42, is not allowed to own guns or ammunition because he has previous convictions of rape, drug trafficking, and aggravated robbery.
Oh, my gosh.
So he now faces between 19 to 24 years in prison if he is convicted. And the story is, for all of you that don't know, Clements is accused of chaining Forrest, a bull mastiff, to a tree on November 25th in Forest Hill Park, firing at him four times and hitting him twice. But there is a good ending to the story. Forrest was later found by a professional dog walker and rescued by Paws, and then he was adopted into a home. So, you know, there's the good ending of that story that's heartbreaking. And another sad story, unfortunately. So in Sullivan, Indiana, the sheriff's department in Sullivan County is cracking down on a suspected case of animal abuse and cruelty that one veterinarian calls the worst he's ever seen. A tip on Tuesday afternoon led investigators to a mobile home on South Main Pleasant Street in the small town in Pleasantville, when sheriff's deputies found the unthinkable: three dog carcasses, two dog skulls, and two dogs surviving, but barely, one by feeding on the carcass of a cage mate. So it's pretty grim. And the two new shelter residents are of a hound dog breed, based on the staffer's best estimation. They are newly named Charlie, who's said to be the stronger of the two, and Bosifus, a mixed breed pup who is believed to be well under a year old. Both dogs, according to staffers, will be up for public adoption once the criminal proceedings play out in court. And as of news time Wednesday, unfortunately, no formal charges have been filed in the animal cruelty case. This is another kind of interesting story. It's from Bucharest, Romania. A man known as Nutsu the pawnbroker has been indicted for leading a fearsome criminal gang, but the public seems to be more interested in his pets, which include four lions and two bears. Authorities won't confirm that the lions and bears were used to intimidate rivals at his high-walled and heavily guarded estate in the poorest part of Bucharest, Romania. The compounds also contained other animals, including thoroughbred horses and canaries. Ballant, 48, a stocky man with a mustache and receding hairline, often appears dressed in t-shirts and tracksuits. And the Romanian news media were unaware or awash in unconfirmed reports that Ballant's excesses, reporting that he used lions and bears to intimidate rivals, and that his house contained a torture chamber. However, the neighbors and relatives described Ballant as a good neighbor and an animal lover and said they weren't bothered by roaring lions. It kind of sounds like a conflicting story, but these animals, which generally appeared in good condition, fortunately, will be temporarily housed in a zoo and may eventually be relocated in South Africa, animal welfare officers are saying. So that, I mean, at least hopefully they are relocated in South Africa, and again, hopefully a good ending to this story.
Wow, that actually reminds me a lot of on Michael Moore's TV show before. He had gone and like basically set it up so that this person looked like a serial killer. He rented a house and like he made killing noises at night and took like sketchy bags out to the garbage. And all the neighbors were like, "Oh, he was a lovely boy."
Yeah,
and like
absolutely.
He was a great person and no one
yeah.
really knew. So.
It's really interesting because there's so many conflicting arguments on this case. So I hope that they can figure out the truth. And just one other quick story. I'm sure some people have heard about. Singer Morrissey had canceled a Jimmy Kimmel appearance because as he says, serial animal killers from Duck Dynasty will also be appearing on that show.
What's Duck Dynasty? I've just heard about that in the last day. Something about ducks.
They sell. It's a TV show. I've actually never seen it, but I was just researching about it for this news story. And apparently, it's a show that follows a Louisiana family that has a business selling duck calls and decoys, so to help duck hunters, basically.
Well, good for him for taking a stand.
It is good. Yeah,
he's a vegetarian singer. Yeah. That's all I know. Well, thank you for the news there.
No problem.
For our feature interview today, we have Dr. Stephen Wise with us, who is the president of an organization called the Non-Human Rights Project, as well as the author of such books as Drawing the Line, Science and the Case for Animal Rights, and Rattling the Cage Toward Legal Rights for Animals. The Non-Human Rights Project is the only organization working toward actual legal rights for the members of species other than our own. Their mission is to change the common law status of at least some non-human animals from mere things which lack the capacity to possess any legal right to persons who possess such fundamental rights as bodily integrity and bodily liberty and those other legal rights to which evolving standards of morality, scientific discovery, and human experience entitle them. Stephen is here today to speak with us about this project. Hello, Stephen, and welcome to the Animal Voices radio show.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Well, you say that you're unlike any other organization in the world, which is certainly true. I'm curious to know first about the background of the Non-Human Rights Project and how it got started, as well as the people who are behind the organization. Could you tell us about that, please?
Sure. The Non-Human Rights Project began under another name, the Center for the Expansion of Fundamental Rights, in 1996, and I organized that corporation in order to begin the process of figuring out how to gain legal rights for non-human animals through litigation. And it operated at a relatively low level until about 2006. And in 2006, I finished doing background books and law review articles, and I'd been teaching animal rights law for 15 years. And I announced that now we were done theorizing, and now we were going to begin preparing for the suits. And that's what we did. And I'm now supervising about 70 people scattered throughout the United States. We have a full-time executive director. We have a staff attorney. And we have put in about 30,000 hours of work preparing for these cases, and we're going to begin filing them at the end of this year.
That's really impressive. To get more into about what you're doing exactly, can you talk to us about the legal status that animals are afforded now in North America, at least, and the legal wall that has separated the human animals from the non-human animals from as early as I can think of, at least?
Sure. Well, non-human animals have been legal things in our jurisprudence for as long as I know. And a legal thing means that they really don't have the capacity to have any rights at all. So they don't have any legal rights, and they never have had any rights. And of course, there were once human beings who were like that too. There were slaves in England. There were villeins. At times, women were there, children might be there, and other human beings, and that status is now occupied by non-human animals, as it always has been. And if you don't have legal rights, you're essentially invisible to the civil law system, and the only way in which you can kind of pop into visibility is for someone to be able to get you those rights, so that you become a legal person instead of a legal thing, and have the capacity for an unlimited number of rights. And that's the purpose of the work of the Non-Human Rights Project, is to have the judges use the common law, which is the law that judges make in all English-speaking countries, make the decision to transfer at least some non-human animals from the legal status of things to the legal status of persons.
So, right, as you were saying, the purpose of the Non-Human Rights non-human rights project is clear. It's to break through the legal wall that separates the humans from the non-humans. You wish to gain legal personhood for non-human animals, and I understand that you'll be beginning with some animals that we as humans deem to be the most intelligent on Earth, such as chimpanzees, elephants, and dolphins. Could you start by, could you tell us about the cases that you are filing, and as you were talking about which court of law, the common law?
Well, we have been trying to figure out what American state we want to file our first cases in. So the good news is that there's 50 choices, 51, including the District of Columbia, from which we could choose. And the bad news is that there's 51 jurisdictions from which we can choose. So one of the reasons we spent 3,000 hours in 6 years working on this is that we've very carefully analyzed the applicable law through all 51 jurisdictions, trying to figure out which jurisdictions might be the most favorable or at least hostile to accepting the sort of arguments that we want to put forward. And we have slowly been narrowing those jurisdictions down. And we have a legal working group, and our legal working group these days has been meeting, say, for the last year and a half, has been meeting every few months in Manhattan, where we shut ourselves up in a hotel room for 2 days, and we argued through our jurisdictions. And at our last one, we narrowed our jurisdictions down to five, and we're hoping to bring two cases simultaneously. So right now we're shooting to narrow those jurisdictions down from five to two, and we have a meeting again in our hotel room in Manhattan the weekend of March 30th, 31st, Easter weekend, in which we hope to then narrow those five jurisdictions down to two. Then we will then bring one suit apiece in those two jurisdictions sometime near the end of 2015.
Can you talk to us more about why you choose common law and not the federal law? I imagine a lot of our listeners are just regular lay people. We don't really understand why one law and not the other. If you could get into that a little bit, please.
Sure. There's a lot of different kinds of law. There's international law. There's federal constitutional law, federal statutory law. There's state constitutional law, state statutory law, state common law, municipal law, regulations. It just keeps coming. And there are different administrative bodies and different legal bodies who administer and make these kinds of laws. And so one thing that we wanted to do from the beginning is to not seek to have judges reinterpret statutes or constitutions, because when judges are interpreting a statute or judges interpreting a constitution, he or she will oftentimes look to legislative history behind them, the intent of Congress, say, or the intent of a state legislature, and we were quite concerned that that the court would say that the Congress or the other legislature never intended to include non-human animals within its meaning. In fact, that was the buzzsaw that PETA ran into when it filed a lawsuit in the federal court in San Diego in the fall of 2011, claiming that an orca should be considered a slave within the meaning of the 13th mm-hmm. Amendment to the United States Constitution. We came in, we actually filed a friend of the court brief and really strongly opposed what PETA was doing, because we thought that there was no chance whatsoever that PETA could win, because the legislative history of the 13th Amendment was such that a judge would find that they were only intended to that it only intended to cover human beings. So the purpose of the common law, which now I've been working on for 25 years, or the common law itself is inherently flexible in a way that a statute or a constitutional provision is not. And there is no legislative history. The common law is supposed to be flexible. Judges are supposed to take into account changing scientific information, changing experience, changing morality in order to keep the common law harmonious and current with all these things. So we don't have to worry about going in front of a judge and asking the judge to change his or her mind about how our non-human animal plaintiff should be viewed and argue that she should be viewed as a legal person rather than a legal thing. but because we can argue that experience has changed. Morality is shifting. There's been a huge amount of scientific discovery about the cognitive abilities of animals such as our non-human animal plaintiffs, and that the judge herself does have the power under the common law to make the kind of changes that we are urging her to do.
When you say that perceptions are changing, do you mean like even in the last 10 years? Because I know you wrote a blog post about that you were asked about 10, 12 years ago if now is the right time to put forth these cases, and you said no, it'll be right in about 10 years. So has this just been in the last 10 years that you feel that maybe perhaps perceptions are changing towards animals?
Yes. Things have been changing a lot. I have now been working on this project since 1985.
Wow.
So it's been 28 years. And I first began thinking about this in 1985 and at the end of the 1980s. And I realized that at that time, there were no law school classes. There were no law school books. There were very little legal cases. There was hardly anything that had been done in the area that would cause a judge to feel that he or she should be able to make the kind of change we wanted. And so at that point, in the mid-1980s, I decided that we had to begin to create the area of animal rights law, or at least create the conditions under which courts would feel that they could make the sort of changes we're asking. And so now, 27, 28 years later, there are law school classes on animal rights or animal protection being taught in 120, 130
right.
law schools. There are chapters of the Student Animal Legal Defense Fund. There are probably 6 animal law journals. There are I don't know how many case books, probably 3 or 4, and judges and lawyers now have been exposed to the whole idea of an animal protection lawyer or an animal rights lawyer, and then there's other things as well, that scientists now by the dozens and dozens have been doing cognitive research on animals, both in the labs and in the wild, and the facts, the evidence that so many non-human animals are extraordinarily cognitively advanced and complex, we think the time has come that we can kind of marry those things together, put on the scientific evidence that will persuade a court that they're dealing with these extraordinary beings, and showing how the time is right in the law, and that the judges indeed have the power to change the law to harmonize with these changing facts.
So regarding the law, and to obtain personhood in the United States, what are the criteria that must be answered? Can you talk a little bit about that and the criteria that the court will be looking at as to answering the cases that you're filing?
Well, we've been arguing, I've been arguing for a long time, that the idea of autonomy really lies at the heart of personhood, or at least under one conception of personhood that I think a judge would accept as sufficient. So about 13 years ago in my first book, Rattling the Cage, I put forward the idea of what I call practical autonomy. What's really the smallest degree of autonomy that a court would find would be sufficient to recognize that our non-human animal plaintiff should be a legal person and have certain kinds of fundamental rights. And so practical autonomy really exists, I argue, when a creature is cognitively complicated enough to want something, to be able to act intentionally, to achieve their want, to achieve their goal, and to have some kind of sense to be able to care, to be cognitively complicated enough to be able to care whether they can achieve their goal or not. Do they have consciousness? Do they have self-consciousness? Do they have a theory of mind? How complex is their consciousness? And when they have a fairly complicated consciousness, they can act intentionally to achieve their goals. They can really make a life for themselves and care about what kind of life they have. That should be a sufficient condition, at least one sufficient condition, for declaring that non-human animal ought to be a legal person with certain kinds of fundamental rights that protect their certain kinds of fundamental interests.
I would think that even with just what you've said there, that would call for most animals being able to be granted legal rights.
I think that's really amazing to hear you also talk about animals having goals, but in regards to yourself as well, the fact that you've been working on this for 28 years I think is really inspiring. I was just curious, like, what's motivated you to keep going throughout all that time and to continue working on this really important issue?
Well, the reason I became a lawyer is to correct injustices. I know it may sound kind of banal, but that's why I became a lawyer. I could have done a lot of other things. I've been interested in a lot of other things. And in 1979, I was a very young lawyer, and I ran into Peter Singer's book. Mm-hmm. And when I read it, I said, well, wait a minute. I did not know that non-human animals were being treated like this. And I can't imagine a field of law in which I could make a better impact and ease pain and suffering more than if I became an animal rights lawyer. And so I joined up with a very, very small number of other lawyers in the world who are interested in doing that at the time. And we've only learned more and more and got more and more sophisticated in the way we approach. And also the entire world has begun to catch up with us. You know, in the early 1980s, I walked into courtrooms and I would have people bark at me. And that doesn't happen anymore. And there weren't any classes. Now I've taught at the Vermont Law School. I've taught animal rights law there now for 24 years. I've taught animal rights law at Harvard Law School and other law schools. And I lecture and teach around the world. And that's just, you know, not the world. The world of 2013, where I can do those things, is not the world of 1981. And so I'm kind of prodded forward by the fact that I can see the world changing, and I can see that the time has now come to begin making these kinds of concrete advances in law.
I think that's all really encouraging to hear. Just on the flip side of the coin, you know, stuff like this doesn't happen overnight, and I would just imagine many people still inherently believe that animals are things, they're objects to be treated as property. Can you talk about the kind of resistance that you expect to meet in this process, and what would arguments be against the goal for granting personhood for non-human animals?
Well, sure. The idea that a non-human animal is a legal thing that can be property has been around for thousands of years. But, of course, some humans were in there as well. And one of the things, actually, that's kept me going is I've become kind of a scholar of human slavery. And, indeed, my third book, Though the Heavens May Fall, told the story of James Somerset, who was a black slave in London in 1772, and how he was able to use the legal system to become a legal person and gain his freedom. And the fact that there's been, that it took so many centuries of pushing to end human slavery really gives me a lot of patience. I understand the kind of pushback that can happen. The fact that millions and millions and millions of people you know, eat animals or use animals or exploit animals or have jobs that depend upon the exploitation of animals. And essentially, a substantial part of our world assumes that non-human animals are legal things without any rights, and we really don't have to care very much about them. And so we've been there before with human slavery, and mm-hmm. I understand that there is a pushback. There's always going to be a pushback, and the way that we deal with that is we decide that nothing but nothing is ever going to discourage us, and we're going to continue to do what is right because the tides of history and the arc of morality are on our side, and all we have to do is have enough committed, dedicated, smart people just push and push and push and not care if we lose. We just keep pushing and pushing, and eventually we will win.
I agree with you. I think eventually you will win. And if and when you win these cases, what do you predict the outcome will be, in particular with setting precedents for the rights of animals all over the world? And what will this mean for animals in the legal system?
Well, it'll be an extraordinary thing. The first step we're taking is the hardest step, which is persuading a court that they should that they should view our non-human animal plaintiff, whether she's a chimpanzee or an orca or an Asian elephant, that she should be viewed as a legal person who has the capacity for some kind of a right, as opposed to a legal thing. And I compare it sometimes to a Catholic transubstantiation, the idea that one moment you have this host that seems to be made out of bread, or you have wine, and the next moment it's the body and blood of Christ, yet it looks the exact same. And that is what we're actually shooting for, what I call a legal transubstantiation, where this non-human animal, like my black slave James Somerset was in London in 1772, will look the exact same way. But once a court accepts that they're no longer things who don't have the capacity for any rights at all, but are legal persons who have the capacity for an unknown number of rights, they really leave the courtroom, you know, a dramatically changed legal individual. And once that happens, then we simply bring case, and others will bring case after case after case in the United States and throughout the world, trying to flesh out and make what sort of rights they should have, what sort of animals should have them, because after all, there's a million species of animals, and they're dramatically different, and a beetle and a chimpanzee or a firefly and an orca are dramatically different beings. And so courts are going to have to deal with which animals should be legal persons, and of the legal persons, which rights should they be entitled to have.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for coming on the show today to speak with us about your efforts in the Non-Human Rights Project. I would love to have you on the show again later in the year, this time next year, you know, when more progress has been made, to see what has come of this. To keep updated on the progress of the project, please visit nonhumanrightsproject.ca. Thank you and good luck.
Nonhumanrights.org.
.org. Sorry about that.
.org. That's fine. And also, keep up with us on Facebook as well. And I would be delighted to speak to you again. And at that point, I won't be telling you what we're going to do. I'll be telling you what we've done and what we're doing.
Thanks so much. Take care.
You're very welcome. Bye.
You've been listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show on 100.5 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Next Friday is International Women's Day, and we'll be providing special programming for that day, which will include an interview with Lisa Kemmerer, who is the editor of the book Sister Species and a contributor to the new book called Defiant Daughters. We here at Animal Voices Show modestly ask that you keep connected with the Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. You can do so by signing up for our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. And please send us your suggestions and comments about the show, either on Facebook via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, and also check out our website at animalvoices.org.
Next, we want you to stay tuned for Radio EcoShock, but first, we're introducing the debut performance of the Vancouver Vegan Prom theme song, a.k.a. Save the Daya. So, here goes. What makes an ordinary day something incredible? What makes an average person say they're indestructible? How does a hero find their special sign when it's normal part of the design? You're on your way, you're gonna save the day, yeah. You're on your way, you're gonna save the day, yeah. One bite at a time, a tasty, melty delight. You're on your way, you're gonna save the day, yeah. It'll be an awesome, great, good time. You don't need a special suit to change the world. You don't have to fly in the sky to get the boy or girl. No need for fighting, it starts deep inside. A little planning, you can liberate a life. You're on your way, you're gonna save the day, yeah. You're on your way, you're gonna save the day, yeah. One bite at a time, a tasty, melty delight. You're on your way, you're gonna save the day, yeah. It'll be an awesome, great, good time. When everything's at stake, not at the vegan prom, what are you prepared to do? as a hero, there's one choice. It's up to you to pull through. Bang, rock, sock, pow. Making the world a better place right now. Roar, huzzah, grr, yeah, yum. Little by little, helping everyone. You're on your way, you're gonna save the day, yeah. You're on your way. One bite at a time, a tasty, melty delight. You're on your way, you're gonna save the day, yeah. It'll be an awesome, great, good time.